16-year-old Amal Shaheed sits in a courtroom wearing the gray suit his mother chose for optics, painfully aware that no clothing can make him any less black in the eyes of the justice system. As the jury delivers their guilty verdict for aggravated assault, Amal feels his world collapse. "There's a stone in my throat, a brick on my chest. The stone becomes a mountain, the brick a building, and it feels like the whole world is pressing down on me." In an instant, he transforms from promising art student to convicted criminal. The prosecution has successfully twisted everything about Amal against him. His hoodie seen as a mask, his hand gestures as gang signs, his academic struggles as stupidity. Even his art teacher betrays him, testifying that she works with Amal to channel his anger into his art, never truly seeing him beyond his creative output. The stark reality of American justice hits him as he's led away in handcuffs. Where I come from, jail or death were my options. Where he comes from, the American dream was the only option. Inside juvenile detention, Amal's identity is reduced to an inmate number. He's forced to forget his school ID, his college aspirations, his class schedule, everything that made him who he was. This transformation represents the dehumanization that occurs when young black men enter a system designed to process rather than protect them. Before his arrest, Amal was a talented artist at East Hills High School for the Arts. In detention, this identity becomes his lifeline, the one part of himself the system cannot fully take away. Given a notebook and pencil, Amal discovers, "I didn't know that I could hold this little bit of freedom in my hands." Drawing and poetry become acts of resistance in a place where his body is no longer his own. His artistic growth accelerates when Imani Dawson, a poet and prison abolitionist, begins teaching creative writing workshops. Through her prompts, Amal processes his experience and distinguishes between his regrets and missed warning signs. When Amal and fellow inmates paint a visiting room mural showing everyone with wings, all of us flying above chaos, authorities paint over it, claiming it contained gang symbols. Despite this censorship, Amal persists, creating miniature remixes of famous works with a child's watercolor set that speak to his confinement. Inside juvenile detention, Amal discovers a complex social ecosystem with its own hierarchies. Initially isolated, he forms connections with other boys, particularly Caden, who offers protection. "You need us. We got your back." Though Amal first resists joining any crew, he soon realizes survival requires allies. Caden and his friends, Amal's four corners, shield him from white inmates who target him because of his case. These relationships expose the facility's racial segregation, unlike Amal's arts high school, where students blended like a paint palette of colors, shades, and beliefs. In detention, they're cheap markers that don't blend, forcing everyone to stay in the lines, or else the colors will bleed. When Caden returns, beaten with one eye sealed shut, Amal feels powerless. Later, when Amal's mural is destroyed, Caden comforts him. "Calm down, young Basquiat. There are more walls here. We got nothing but fucking walls." From the moment Amal enters detention, he's processed like meat or wheat, made into a burger or bread. This dehumanization starts with confiscating personal items and imposing orange jumpsuits. The facility's architecture and routines strip away autonomy through rigid scheduling. Amal notes the pipeline linking school discipline to incarceration, recalling his middle school, mentally renamed Zero Tolerance Academy, or Prison Prep. Control operates through psychological manipulation and physical intimidation. Officer Beal, nicknamed Tattoo for his disturbing image of a black baby with a noose, exemplifies this cruelty, once violently restraining Amal simply for making art with stolen markers. Most insidiously, the system aims to control minds, not just bodies. When Dr. Benu teaches about the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery except as a punishment for crime, Amal realizes, if we've been convicted of a crime, we're slaves. Our lives belong to the state. The profound relationship between Amal and his mother, Umi, serves as his lifeline to identity beyond detention. He describes her face as the most beautiful in the world, with skin like sleeping in on snow days beneath thick blankets. Throughout his incarceration, Umi advocates relentlessly for her son, visiting despite difficulties, bringing letters and books, and replacing his ineffective lawyer. During visits, Amal battles conflicting emotions, yearning for her mother's comfort while maintaining emotional armor. If I close my eyes, I might melt in her arms and she'd have to carry me home in her cupped hands. When Amal suggests fewer visits, Umi responds firmly, "Your struggle is my struggle. Your hurt is my hurt." This unconditional love sustains him through his darkest moments. In one powerful scene, Umi embraces him while whispering her favorite lyrics that affirm their shared strength. The events of that night, when Jeremy Mathis was severely beaten, haunt the narrative, gradually revealed through Amal's reflections. Amal admits early, "I threw the first punch," complicating any simple narrative of innocence. Yet the full context reveals a situation more nuanced than the prosecution portrayed. The incident occurred against a backdrop of neighborhood gentrification and racial tension. Amal explains their neighborhood was changing, gentrification creating an invisible line we couldn't cross, while those white boys crossed into our territory without care. The confrontation began when Amal and Omari found white boys using their basketball courts as a skate park. The court narrative omitted the mutual nature of the conflict. The situation escalated with someone grabbing a bat, someone yelling racial slurs, someone calling the cops. The media and justice system framed the incident through a racial lens that criminalized Amal while portraying Jeremy as an innocent victim. "We were a mob, thugs, men. They were kids, having fun, full of potential, boys." Hope remains a persistent force, embodied in Amal's name, which means hope in Arabic. This isn't naive optimism, but determination to maintain dignity in dehumanizing circumstances. Early in detention, Amal creates a mantra, "I hope that they don't kill me in there. I hope I can handle the pain. I hope I have time to heal. I hope I am stronger than I think." Zenobia's letters provide emotional sustenance with affirmations like, "I know your character," and "I believe you." When Amal receives these letters, he holds them against my chest, where the brick is, where the building is, where the city is. These letters are putting me back together. The butterfly emerges as a transformation symbol. Amal explains how a butterfly's wings can create tiny changes leading to massive effects, wondering if his feelings or Jeremy's truth will change one big thing, my whole damn life. The novel concludes with Jeremy awakening to give his statement, reminding us that behind juvenile delinquent headlines are young people with dreams. Amal's art and poetry resist a system determined to define him by his worst moment.